Blog Talk Radio.
What's up, y'all? I like to start every show with y'all, too, apparently. Even though I don't think I've ever said that in real life. I don't think I've ever said y'all like that in real life. I should probably start. I like the way it flows off the tongue. Interesting show today. A lot of fun stuff. We got Bernie Sanders. We got some good news about Bernie Sanders, kind of. Kind of. I stress the kind of part because it shows how popular he is, but at the same time, you'll see there's a massive downside to this story. I'm going to kick it off with that in just a second. We also have a whole bunch on Scott Walker. Scott Walker announced his presidential run this week, and he wants you to know that God wants him to run. It's not him that decided to run. It's actually God told him to run. Yeah. We also have a lot on his record. Apparently God also told him that people don't deserve a living wage, because that's how God rolls. We have a hilarious Donald Trump theory. Somebody thinks that there's actually no way that he's real. It must be that he's basically a Democratic Manchurian candidate trying to tank the Republicans. Oh, goodness gracious, I love their theories and how splendidly made up they are. I don't even know if splendidly can be used in that context. Can you say splendidly? Whatever, we'll go with that. Great news with Iran. We have the final deal set. And actually, the Congress is not going to be as big of a roadblock as I had originally thought they were, because of the way that not only the way that the deal is structured, but the way that they went about negotiating the treaty. I thought Congress was going to find a way to tank this thing eight ways to Sunday, but it's going to be pretty hard for them to do so. So that's fantastic news. Netanyahu's response to that. We got Fox News hosts almost coming to blows, which is hilarious. I wish they actually did. And what else I got, man? Your normal crazy theocratic bullshit and the story about a group that actually came out to defend Donald Trump, even though Donald Trump had admitted that he pretty much was drugging women to fuck him. So, really, really jam-packed, Joe. Let's get started and kick it off here, like I said, with that interesting story on Bernie Sanders. So Bernie Sanders' campaign has out-fundraised all the Republican contenders. But, of course, there's one tremendous loophole, which, in essence, rigged the game against him. So this is really interesting because if you think about it, the fact that you're able to fundraise from more people would indicate what? You're actually more popular. But the thing is, the Republicans, because of the super PAC system and the way that's set up, they're actually raising more as a dollar amount. So let me give you more details on that. Raw Story explains, quote, "The Sanders campaign on the Democratic side has managed to tap small donors to quickly raise large totals. As of its most recent reporting, the campaign raised $15 million from 400,000 donations, wow, from 200,000 donors. In contrast, Jeb Bush raised $11.4 million, okay, wow, so less, and Ted Cruz raised around $14 million, again, less. No GOP campaign matched the Sanders haul." And then they continue and say, but there's a catch, like I was alluding to. While Sanders is creating the broadest base of financial support, there is another factor at play, super PACs. They allow billionaires and corporations to effectively spend whatever they want. Bush's super PAC raised $103 million, around 10 times as much as the candidate raised through his actual campaign. And Cruz's super PAC raised over $30 million, twice as much as what his campaign raised. So we were speaking about this a few weeks ago. Jeb Bush and a bunch of other Republican candidates did the sleaziest political trick imaginable. What they did is they held off on officially announcing their presidential run solely so they can go around and raise money for their super PACs. And when you raise money for your super PACs, there's no cap whatsoever. There's no limits whatsoever. So corporations and billionaires can just throw money at you and make it rain. So the idea is, well, the second we announce, then there's some slightly more strict campaign finance rules that go into effect, and I can't talk to my super PAC. So let me just basically tell everybody I'm going to run in not so many words, raise money for the super PAC, and then eventually officially announce, and then they're already set with a tremendous amount of money. Now, Bernie Sanders decided, I'm not even going to do a super PAC. Now, I told you guys at the beginning, I'm actually kind of split on that because he actually would have a better chance of winning if he did a super PAC. But then again, if he did it, he would appear to be a hypocrite because he always speaks out against money in politics and he wants to do campaign finance reform. And people could use that against him and say, well, you say you're against it, then why are you doing it? But I don't know how much I buy that argument, because if the system is set up as it is, to not do that would be unilateral disarmament. You can disagree with the system, you know, but still partake in it if it's already set up like that, and then if slash when you get elected, change the system. But I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. That's another conversation for another day, so I digress from that. But the bottom line is, as they laid out clearly, Bernie Sanders raised more money from more people, small donors, regular people, and the Republican candidates raised much less for their actual campaigns from people, but they're raising the bulk of their money from corporations and from billionaires, and it's going through their super PAC. So this is like basically a study. It's like a scientific study that was set up perfectly to see how broken our democracy is. Because you have people like Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz raise way more money when their ideas aren't nearly as popular. And the only reason they're raising that money is because it's a wink and a nod to the corporations and the billionaires. We're going to do your bidding. We're going to do what you want, so you give us money. And meanwhile, the person who actually represents the American people raised much less, and it's almost like you can't have a fair system if private money is involved, because how could it possibly be fair when there's such tremendous inequality in who has wealth? I mean, if money equals free speech, then quite literally, some voices are just louder than others. You're going to have Sheldon Adelson's vote and his voice count much more than some grandmother who lives in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And that, in my opinion, fundamentally violates the idea of one man, one vote. I mean, it should be that we're all heard equally and that we actually legislate in a representative democracy based on what the people want. But that idea is now so far gone and so removed from the system that people look at these facts and they go, well, yeah, what'd you expect? And where's the media on this, man? The media's job is to look at this and go, hey, wait a second. This seems a little fucked up. This seems like it's the opposite of what a democracy is supposed to be. But, of course, they're so used to it. And they also are the benefactors of money in politics because it buys ads that they just go, oh, I guess it is what it is and we won't even discuss it. Well, you're doing a disservice to the American people by not discussing it. And the system as it's set up, of course, a disservice to the American people and a slap in the face to democracy. Okay. Now, let's move on here to Governor Scott Walker, because he's pissing me off more now, and I think as time goes on and we get deeper and deeper into this Republican primary, he might actually be my least favorite of all of them. He might even be worse than Ted Cruz. I mean, there's something about this guy, man, that it's like he was born to be this sellout prick, and he's got the smug look on his face the entire time, right up there with Ted Cruz. So let me set this up for you. Scott Walker not only announced his presidential run this week, he also signed his new state budget into law. And the budget is a disaster. So under Walker, as we already know, the deficit has increased in Wisconsin, even though he said I'm a fiscal conservative and he was supposed to fix that. He didn't. He went after workers and went after unions. That was widely reported about a year or so ago. And he's basically known for his corruption. In fact, he was caught on tape talking to a billionaire saying that the plan against the unions is divide and conquer. Make it so that they actually can't stand up for workers' rights and middle-class rights and to make a higher income and for collective bargaining. And we'll win by crushing them and cheating and doing divide and conquer. But this time, he went even further with his fuck you to the average American. Huffington Post reports, quote, Walker did a last-minute change that strips the words living wage from state laws and replaces it with minimum wage. The change means minimum wage Wisconsin workers will earn nearly $6,000 per year less than what the Massachusetts Institute of Technology calculates is a living wage in the state, and they will have no recourse. MIT says a living wage would be $10.13 an hour, and they'll be paid $7.25 an hour, so significantly less. The new law eliminates the ability of low-wage workers to appeal for a living wage. Previously, Wisconsin law stated that employee pay shall be not less than a living wage, defined as, quote, adequate to permit any employee to maintain herself or himself in minimum comfort, decency, physical, and moral well-being. Okay. The balls on this guy, where the same week that he announces his presidential campaign, he signs a budget and specifically strips out the term living wage and says, I am against a living wage. I am anti-living wage. I'm on the record here. I'm going to change that to minimum wage and make it so that more people in my state get screwed over. Who does that the same week that they run? By the way, if any of the other Republicans want to get serious here and want to attack him and want to try to bring him down in this primary process, bring this up! Now, obviously, I don't want the other Republicans to do well either. I think they're all fucking crazy. But you want to talk about just opening up a door for you to attack him all day long? Who does that? Who does that? Again, it's not even like usually Republicans try to, you know, use code words and beat around the bush and dance around the issue when it comes to just how much they hate workers. He's not even doing that. He's like, okay, take out living wage. I'm against that. I'm against a living wage and put in minimum wage. And also, I told you, the actual written word of the law here, the letter of the law is, living wage was defined as providing people with minimum comfort, decency, physical, and moral well-being. If you're a political opponent to Scott Walker, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, you got to go out there and quote that and say, Scott Walker is literally against a minimal moral well-being. He is saying, I am immoral. I am against your moral well-being. I'm on the side of the opposite of that. I don't care about your moral well-being. And then, by the way, Jackass is going to go out there and lecture everybody about Christianity and lecture everybody about religion and lecture everybody about Jesus and treating everybody kindly. You just signed a bill and struck down the living wage provision, and you said, I am against moral well-being. So, look, I mean, he's a hypocrite in so many different ways. But then it gets even worse, man. It just keeps going downhill. The budget Walker signed, quote, would allow factory and retail employees to work 7 days without a day off as long as they said in writing that they were doing so voluntarily. The old law required employers to give workers at least one day off for every 7 days of work. Now, you might look at that, and some people might look at that and say, well, look, they're doing it voluntarily, so who cares? But what's the problem with that? There's an elephant in the room here. Clout. Who has more clout in the employer-employee relationship? Obviously, the employer does, and the employee has to listen. In fact, that's the way the system is set up. You have a boss that you have to listen to. So they can now apply pressure and say, I don't want you to take a day off, and the person's going to feel pressured because if they don't buckle, then they could be fired, they could lose their livelihood, and somebody can come and take their place. So you're changing the norm from not only a two-day weekend, but they're like, fuck the two-day weekend. We've got 1 day by law we'll put in there. And now they're getting rid of that and say, no. Well, if you want to voluntarily, out of your own free will, work 7 days, we'll let you work 7 days, when we all know effectively it's not really going to be a voluntary situation. There's going to be pressure applied, and people are going to be working nonstop, man. What the fuck? Are we living in a Gilded Age again? Is that what we're doing? Is this a feudal society? That's what you want to do? You want to bring back tenement houses while we're at it here, tenement homes? Put people, 8 people, 10 people, in a little room all together, and let them live a in a horrible situation. You want to scrap the minimum wage while you're at it? He dropped living wage for minimum wage, but you know if he had his way and there were, the federal laws weren't blocking him, he would definitely get rid of the minimum wage too. So this is Scott Walker. This is what he represents here. And then, by the way, as now that you learned all this, I should add another fact into the conversation here, which is he is known for investing more money, taxpayer money, in order to bolster up like stadiums, sports stadiums. So taxpayer money is going to his corporate buddies, his rich friends who he rubs elbows with at different cocktail parties. Taxpayer money is going to them to build sports stadiums, something that should be private, in my opinion. And meanwhile, the workers are getting screwed left and right, whether he's attacking unionization, whether he's cutting benefits, or whether he's getting rid of minimum wage protections and getting rid of the weekend and things like that. So there you go, Republicans. Is this the person that you want? Is this the person that, you know, you're on board with, the person who says, fuck you to the American worker? Well, I think as McDonald's says, have it your way. Okay. Let's move on to vacation, an interesting story about vacations. Probably take our first break after this one here, depending on how long it is. There's a new report out on American workers and their sleep habits. More than 1,100 workers participated in the study, and the findings are pretty sad. They say, quote, nearly 76% of the employees felt tired most days of the week, 15% dozed off during the day at least once per week, just over 10% of those surveyed said a medical condition disturbed their sleep, nearly 30% of employees were unhappy or very unhappy with the quality or quantity of their sleep. So let's pause here and reflect on this real quick. They're saying that of all the people that have sleep issues, just over 10% of them said it was due to a medical condition. So they have, like, you know, medically diagnosed insomnia or other issues that they're dealing with. But 76% said, I feel tired most days of the week. 15% fell asleep one day during the week on the job, didn't even realize it, they just fucking fall asleep. And 30% of employees say, look, I'm really unhappy with the quality and quantity of my sleep. So the downsides of this aren't just, you know, the face value downsides of this, where people are miserable and tired all the time, but they say, quote, U.S. companies lose approximately $63.2 billion in productivity per year, according to a 2011 estimate from Harvard scientists. $63.2 billion per year in productivity is lost because your workers are tired. So what the fuck? I mean, how do we address this problem? A crazy person or an ultra-right winger might look at this and say, drink more caffeine, drink more Red Bull, do some cocaine on the job, do something, stay the fuck awake, make more widgets, goddammit. But in reality, of course, we should be more rational in how we approach this. This clearly is more of a systemic issue than anything else. It's not a problem with any one individual here. So to further dig into this, why don't we go ahead and look at a chart here. This is work hours per country. Now, as you can see there, the countries that work more than the U.S., it's just Mexico, Greece, Chile, Russia, Poland, excuse me, it's funny, Estonia, Hungary, and Turkey, and then pretty much every other modern nation is below the U.S. I mean, you know, you could see some of the names there, Italy, Japan, you got Spain, Canada, U.K. works way less than us, Sweden works way less than us, Denmark works way less than us, Germany, same thing, Netherlands, same thing. So most countries work significantly fewer hours than we do. Now, let's go ahead and take a look at the next chart here because this is also very telling. We've shown this on the show before. This is vacation time by law in various OECD countries. You see, the U.S. there is at zero. Oh, that's so depressing. Paid holidays and paid annual leave in America, as they put it. It's zero by law. Now, the average time people actually take off is a little over a week, which is still incredibly low. And then you have Japan 10 days, Canada 18 days, UK 20 days, and you can go down the list there. You guys see it. I mean, all the other modern nations give a pretty decent amount of time off by law, paid time off by law. It's incredible to think how far behind we are on this issue, and the thing that drives me crazy is that there's very little conversation about changing it. I mean, thankfully, President Obama and the Democrats are pushing a little bit now to try to get, I believe, paid sick leave and paid maternity leave. But, I mean, look, this is something that I don't know why the entire conversation isn't starting from square one all over again, where we wipe the slate clean and we talk about how if you're crafting a society from scratch, what amount of time should you work versus what amount of time should you have, leisure time and do whatever you want. Not everybody works a job that they love, and if you're not working a job you love, then a lot of the time you're fucking miserable doing labor for somebody else. So understanding that and taking that into consideration, fuck, I mean, why isn't the starting point 50-50? Like, half the time you work, the other half the time you do whatever the fuck you want. And people say, well, then you're not going to get shit done. Really? Are you sure about that? I mean, you're only saying that because you're so used to a system where we bust our ass all the time. But you do know that we have technology now. We have computers. We have machines. We have all these things that can do a lot of the work for us. And that's only a problem. It only becomes a problem if people lose their job and they don't have any fucking source of income. And, you know, the machine has taken over everything and the people get no benefit out of that system. The whole purpose of creating the machines in the first place should be to benefit the people so that we have more time to live decent lives while the machines do a lot of the fucking hard work that we don't want to do. So, I mean, to say, like, well, we need to continue to bust our ass all day, every day, nonstop, is for you to fall victim to this mindset of, it must be right because it's how we do it already. Or not. I mean, it's easy to conceive of a situation where we don't do that. And by the way, if you go back and look in American history, we almost passed a four-day work week. We spoke about that before. It was right after during the Great Depression when they were doing the New Deal programs and they were crafting out doing more labor laws and doing more regulation. They were figuring out, well, what should be the standard work week? And I think it passed the Senate and died in the House, or passed the House and died in the Senate, the idea of a four-day work week. It wasn't an extreme position. I mean, William Howard Taft, the Republican president in 1910, I believe it was, he said in an article in the New York Times, he said every working person should get 3 months off by law. That was the conservative Republican position back then. If you say that today, you're immediately branded some sort of communist, crazy, loony, left-wing idiot. So the only reason why it feels weird or it seems weird to have that conversation is because we don't have that conversation. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have that conversation or that it's not a smart conversation to have. The reality is not only should we have that conversation, but the end goal should be like a four-day work week, or it should be whatever, at least 6 weeks paid vacation by law. It's crazy that people have to live their lives being tired and pissed off and angry and falling asleep at work through no fault of their own. It's just because the system is so fucking lopsided and it demands you to rent your labor on the marketplace almost all of your waking hours. There's a lot of things that go into life. I mean, work should not be the main thing that every single thing revolves around. What about friends? What about family? What about love? What about, you know, exhausting passions that are not linked to monetary success and going down that path and trying to grow as a person and reading and learning and all this stuff? In today's America, we put that aside. No, sacrifice everything at the altar of the god of capitalism. No, fuck that. If we're going to have the system of capitalism, it should only exist insofar as it actually continues to advance the human condition. If it starts to hinder the human condition, well, then it's a fucking problem. Now, you guys know I believe in capitalism, but it has to be regulated. You have to have strong labor laws and unions and protections for workers and time off by law and all this stuff. Because if you just let the system run amok and go crazy, you have people that are not viewed as people. They're viewed as piece of the marketplace, and they're totally expendable, and you can be replaced in a second, and they make that decision based on your productivity, not on your human value, and that's a fundamental flaw in the system, which is why it needs to be regulated and we need to check it to make sure it doesn't go out of control. Okay. Let's take a break. When we come back, a Florida Republican lawmaker named Carlos Cubeo has a hilarious comment to make about Donald Trump. Can't wait to discuss that. And we'll definitely dive into this Iranian nuclear deal. We have an agreement, man. And in my opinion, it's a great agreement. You don't want to miss it. Stay right there, guys. We'll be right back.
Tell me how I should live my life. of a bitch. All right, we're back, y'all. Let's get to Donald Trump and laugh.
A Florida Republican lawmaker named Carlos Cubillo has a funny theory about Donald Trump that he shared on Twitter and on a local radio show in Miami. He said, quote, "There are too many important national, local, international topics to waste time talking about a person who, I repeat, in my judgment, is irrelevant and who quite possibly is a phantom candidate recruited by the left to create this entire political circus. I think there's a small possibility that this gentleman is a phantom candidate. Mr. Trump has a close friendship with Bill and Hillary Clinton. They were at his last wedding. He has contributed to the Clintons Foundation, and he has contributed to Mrs. Clinton's Senate campaigns. All of this is very suspicious." Yeah. Hilarious. So his argument is, well, he's such an over-the-top character. He's such a ridiculous human being. He's so stupid that I think it's a liberal conspiracy where they push him into power and they get him into power and then they find a way, he delegitimizes the Republicans. They find a way to make him delegitimize the Republicans. Yeah, here's my counterargument to that. The Republicans are already not very legitimate. Not only that, but dude, if this was the grand liberal plan, it worked. Think about it. So you're saying, come on, he's so stupid, he's so over the top, there's got to be some sort of a game that the left is playing. Well, did you look at the most recent polls on this issue? Donald Trump is leading in the most recent national poll. The Economist and YouGov released the information. He's also leading in some state polls. The more he's really pissed off and angry at immigrants and he blames them for everything, the more the most rabid sectors of the right-wing base go, oh my God, I love him. Totally on his side. So in a way, without this guy even realizing it, dude, you're calling your own base stupid. Because he's saying, look, Donald Trump is so stupid, this has to be some sort of a plot from the left. This isn't, like, real here. Well, why is it that your base fell for it then, huh? How about that? Do you not realize you're slapping your own base in the face when you say that? Slapping your own base in the face. That sounds super sexual, even though it wasn't intended to. So, yeah, dude, I don't think you're onto anything here, but it is interesting, though, to realize that that's true. That actually is true, that, like, the Clintons and Trump, like, yeah, they know each other. I'm sure they've been to some of the same parties together and whatnot. And the thing about that is, that doesn't show that they're on the same page politically as much as it shows that they're in the same class. They're part of the same elite circle. They know that, you know, the Clintons have never met an uber-rich business person they didn't want to suck up to and sell out to. And they look at Donald Trump and they see dollar signs and they see, you know, a way to boost their careers more and for them to be more noteworthy and to get more money and to spread their foundation and to, I mean, the Clintons take money from everybody for their foundation. And then, look, I actually tend to agree with some of the right-wing arguments that say that's one of the reasons why you can't trust Hillary, is that she's taking money from everybody and their mother who's rich. And what the fuck do you think? Like, the Clintons are not going to try to pay back favors and they're not going to talk to the people who they're friends with when they're in office all of a sudden, when she's in office all of a sudden? No, I don't agree with that. But that shows you, man, that class overrides everything. And it really does show you that establishment Democrats and establishment Republicans, while they're different on some issues, social issues specifically, and maybe a little bit on economic issues, they both understand what's really going on here. They both understand you don't do what FDR did, okay? You're not a traitor to your class. That's what they called FDR because he was from a rich background. And when he got in power, he actually cared about the American people, and he kind of crack down on the rich assholes who caused the Depression. So, you're not going to get that from Clinton, and you're not going to get that from Trump. Okay, they know that it's class above all else. It's wealth above all else. Hey, you're on my team. Awesome. But with that being said, of course Donald Trump is not some sort of Manchurian candidate from the left. That would be ridiculous. Plus, we know that you guys are going to self-destruct anyway, because everybody in your party could be a Manchurian candidate. They're all silly enough and dumb enough to fit your conspiracy theory here. I mean, Rick Santorum, Mike Huckabee, really? Out of all the people, you're like, Trump must be the Manchurian candidate. I mean, I could close my eyes, spin in a circle a couple times, and point at some Republican candidate, and you could bet your bottom dollar that they're not going to make the party look good. Carly Fiorina, she's going to make the party. I don't even think Carly Fiorina knows who Carly Fiorina is. She's so irrelevant, her family's like, who the fuck are you? What did you do again? So your theory is ridiculous in various ways. Okay. Next. Oh, boy. The Oklahoma Republican. Anytime that we do a story about the Oklahoma Republican Party or any red state's, Republican Party or base, just know it's going to be funny. It's going to be both funny and depressing at the same time. The Oklahoma Republican Party shared a viral Facebook post about poor people and food stamps, and it's just as loathsome and dumb as you'd expect, so let's take a look at it here. They say, the food stamp program, administered by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, is proud to be distributing this year the greatest amount of free meals and food stamps ever to 46 million people. Meanwhile, the National Park Service, administered by the U.S. Department of the Interior, asks us, please do not feed the animals. Their stated reason for the policy is because the animals will grow dependent on handouts and will not learn to take care of themselves. Thus ends today's lesson in irony. Hashtag OKGOP, and then it shows their website there. Oh, so witty! Oh, you guys are witty, aren't you? It's funny how some people read that and they're like, got them! Yeah, we're so right about everything. Republicans are great. Do you not realize that you just compared human beings to fucking fish and deer and birds and bears? Oh my. Did you not notice that as you wrote that out? And by the way, they put in quotes what they say is the policy of the U.S. Department of the Interior, and they made up the quote. They made it up. I'm going to tell you again how it's worded. The animals will grow dependent on handouts and not learn to take care of themselves. Squirrels are not going to know how to take care of themselves? What does that mean? They phrased it like they're talking about humans here. You want to know why? Because they made it up. It very well may be the case that they say don't feed the animals, but they put in quotes, and that's not an actual quote from the U.S. Department of the Interior. The animals will grow dependent on handouts, right, they just used all right-wing talking points and buzzwords, and will not learn to take care of themselves. They're like a hair's length away from saying, they're not pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. They need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. Please. It's so amazing how they make things up shamelessly. And they just think poorly as they think they're nailing it. So after it was pointed out to them, hey, man, you guys are kind of comparing human beings to reptiles and deer and squirrels and shit. That's a bad idea. Did they come out and say, well, come on, that was a poor choice? No. They did offer an apology, but their apology was more along the lines of, well, I'm so sorry if you don't understand what we're saying. And if you're offended by the point we made, I'm sorry that you're offended by it. It was one of those non-apology apologies. And here's what pisses me off the most about this. They're letting you know exactly what they think. Now, come election season, they'll dance around this and they won't tell you exactly what they think. But the argument, the core of the argument being put forth here is, if you're poor, it's 100% your fault and you should fuck off. That's the argument. Everyone's like, oh, come on, don't give the riffraff, the rabble, the poor people any food. They got to build moral fiber and pull themselves up by their bootstraps. It's on them. It's their fault. They got to step up and do the right thing. And what are they disregarding when they make that argument? Oh, I don't know. Maybe the way the economy functions in the United States of America, the way the system is structured. See, in the mind of a Republican, if the poor person is you, Well, then there's no such thing as a systemic economic problem, which might explain the situation that you're in. But if the poor person is them or their family, oh, well, it wasn't their fault. I mean, they just stumbled on some hard times because this happened and that happened, and that explains why that happened, and they lost their money, and then boom, oh, my God, they need help. So they can go to the government and get unemployment. They can go to the government and get Social Security. They can go and get a welfare check. As well, what do you mean? We're the good people. I don't understand. And by the way, they'll say, hey, we pay taxes, so we're just getting back what we paid in. That's right. That's right. And it's the same thing that goes for anybody else who might end up using a government program temporarily. And by the way, most government programs have hard caps and limits and whatnot. You have to, first of all, apply for the program, and you have to meet the requirements that are necessary. And then after you do that, it's not like most of these programs just go forever. Some of them have limits. Unemployment, for example, runs out at a certain point. So when they say, oh, it's just incentivizing laziness. If it's incentivizing laziness, it's only doing it for a year and a half, maybe 2 years. And then they say, okay, now you got to go, you know, do your thing and try to find a job here. But again, they just make it up, man. And if it were true that these programs, made people more lazy, then what would we see? What would be reflected in the statistics? Higher rates of waste, fraud, and abuse, right? I mean, that's what would happen. It's like, oh, they get used to them, and then they exploit the program, and they use it when they shouldn't use it, and they take advantage. Well, we know what the waste, fraud, and abuse rate is in food stamps, for example. The USDA did a study on that recently. 1%. So what they're actually doing is saying, I want to fuck over the 99% of people who just fell on hard times and need food stamps to get by. I want to fuck them over because 1% of people took advantage of the system. Well, that's a genius way of thinking, isn't it? It's very similar to how they think about Muslims, for example. Very tiny percentage of the Muslim community would be radicals or terrorists or jihadists or whatever. And what do? They just lump them all together. Oh, the evil Muslims, bad Muslims, they're the enemy. It's like they're incapable of nuance. And by the way, for most of the people on food stamps, it's little kids. So it's like $1.50 a meal to pay for a little kid to not starve. It's senior citizens. And it's veterans. So these are the people. They're comparing veterans, little kids, senior citizens to animals. Stay classy. And then they'll turn around and say that, what do you mean? No, we're the party that's for the working man and in favor of the troops. Support our troops, damn it, by sending them to more wars and cutting their food stamps. And you assholes, like I just said, it's about $1.50 on average per meal. That's what you're going to bitch about? So concerned about fiscal responsibility. We can't spend a dime of taxpayer money. Unless, of course, we're talking about what? Corporate welfare. Blank check, bitch. Give them whatever they want and shut the fuck up. Bailouts. Blank check. Give them whatever they want. Money for Wall Street. Money for war. Spend as much money as you want on those things. We're on board and we won't ask a single question about how much it costs. But when it comes to money for people at the bottom of an economic system that is not a perfect system and in many ways fucks them over, they say, I don't care. Even when you explain to them, hey, there are working poor people in America, people that, like, work a full-time job but they don't make enough money to have a bare minimum living standard, so they, like, need a little bit of money to survive. Even when you explain that to them, I'm against it. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. But I just told you, they're working full-time, and the job that they're in does not pay them enough money to survive. And there's millions of those jobs around the U.S. We have millions of working poor people. Working poor people. Get a job. They have a job. They still need the social safety net. Get a job. I don't care. You might say I'm caricaturing, right? Actual example, there's a case of a Republican politician. Somebody went up to him and asked him a very similar question about the minimum wage and it being a living wage. And his response was, get a job. The guy's like, I have a job. He's like, get a job. That about sums it up. That's the Republican position on being kind to the poor and trying to fix the economic system and have a social safety net. Their response is, fuck off. I forgot the question. Okay. Now, all right, let's do the Iran deal real quick. When I say real quick, I really don't mean that because it's going to take a while. But that's expected. A lot of facts to go over, son. That's how we roll. All right. So a couple of months ago, we discussed the randomly lost connection there. My bad. I'm going to start the story over. We were probably like 2 seconds into the story anyway. No biggie. So a couple months ago, we discussed the framework of the new peace deal with Iran, which was released to the public by the State Department. Well, today we have the final draft that all the sides in the negotiation have agreed to. So in many ways, it's a historic day. It's now full success, I guess you could say, when it comes to these peace negotiations. Of course, in the U.S., they're still going to have to get over the hurdle of Congress, but that's not necessarily going to be as big as a problem as many of us originally thought it would be. So let me go ahead and break it down. Think Progress reports here, quote, as Iran shows complicity with the terms of the agreement, sanctions will be lifted by the U.S., EU, and the United Nations, releasing $100 million in frozen Iranian assets. A mechanism is also in place should Iran violate the deal that would put sanctions back in place over a period of 65 days. So that's the baseline, I guess you could say, of the deal. The U.S. and the international community are going to get rid of the sanctions slowly as Iran proves that they're complying with their side of the deal. And then if at any point they violate it, it's called the snapback provision, where the sanctions immediately go back in place, and that would take a total of 65 days to get them all back in place in an efficient way. They continue and say, in exchange, Iran has agreed to curb the amount of time they can produce a nuclear weapon from a few months to over 10 years. Now, some people might read that, specifically the ultra-right wing, and say, well, come on, that's crazy, because in 10 years, they could still have a bomb. But most importantly, in writing, we have, quote, Iran reaffirms that under no circumstances will Iran ever seek, develop, or acquire any nuclear weapons. All right, so let's remember that. Let's keep that in mind, because you're going to hear a lot of propaganda from the right over, you know, the upcoming weeks here, actually 2 months, because that's how long they have to go over the deal. And they're just going to lie. They're going to say, oh, this paves the way for a bomb for Iran. Except the deal says, quote, Iran reaffirms that under no circumstances will Iran ever seek, develop, acquire any nuclear weapons. So they're going to say the opposite, and I need you to keep in mind that in writing in the deal is that. So they can lie all they want, but we know what the deal says. Now, you could argue, well, hey, we don't believe them, but that's fine, because the deal is not based on trust, as President Obama has said time and time again. It's actually based on verification. It involves the UN and the IAEA and inspectors and all this stuff. This isn't just, oh, you said you're gonna do the right thing, dog? Wonderful. Let's go grab a sandwich. That's not the way this works. Okay, so keep all that in mind. They continue and say, Iran will not enrich uranium over 3.67% and will sell or dilute all uranium under its possession that is already enriched. So in other words, what that means is the uranium that they're going to have can only be enriched for purposes of research, scientific research, and power for their power grid, for their people. And they're getting rid of all the uranium that's enriched above that. Now, as of before this deal, they could have broken out and tried to enrich the uranium more to get a nuclear weapon in a few months. It would have taken just a few months to create that nuclear weapon. Now we're at the point where, under this deal, they're getting rid of all that uranium, and it's enriched at such a low level that even if they wanted to break out and create a bomb and violate the deal, it would take 10 years to get to that point. So, and remember, some Republicans are going to say, well, they shouldn't have any nuclear program at all, whatsoever. But the reality is that even under international law, which already exists, it says that any nation is allowed to have nuclear power for purposes of scientific research and for their power grid for their population. And that's exactly what they have here. This deal only reaffirms that and says, okay, you're allowed to have that, but only that, and we're going to keep an eye on it. They continue, the IAEA will regularly inspect Iran's nuclear sites, as they do already, and the UN inspectors can demand special access whenever they want, and a predetermined joint commission made up of one member from each negotiating state will then have to approve the inspection. Okay, so this is another really important part here, because the Republicans are going to say, well, I want to be able to go in there whenever with no restrictions whatsoever, so I don't like this provision because it puts a restriction on us. Now, the way it's worded, it does appear that, you know, there is some sort of a hurdle to get over. But what are they missing? They're missing that the panel is made up of all Western nations and Iran. If Iran wants to stop the IAEA from going in there, they're not going to be able to stop them. Because all the countries will say, yeah, it's just an inspection. Go ahead. But here's why, again, why this is really important. This provision, the way it's worded, allows Iran to go back to their right wing, okay, which is not Hassan Rouhani, the president. It is the Ayatollah, but that's a different conversation. So they can go to their right wing and their population and say, well, what do you mean? We didn't give the big bad Americans access at any time. See, they have to get approval from this this international body that we set up, which would have to, you know, give the okay before they go in there. So I think this is a fantastic provision because it's politically brilliant. It allows Iran to make the argument in their population that, well, we got something. I mean, you know, we made it so that they can't just come in whenever they want. We still are a sovereign country, and we get to do whatever we want. They can say that to their population. And in the U.S., they could come here and say the truth, which is, yeah, we need to get approval from this international body, but guess what? The international body is going to do whatever the fuck we want anyway. So I think it's politically brilliant, and I think both sides sat down and really ironed that out so they know they could go back to their populations and argue that they got the better deal, and they're essentially both right. So then also they say, quote, 5 years from now, Iran will be allowed to buy and sell conventional arms on the international market. 8 years from now, Iran can buy and sell ballistic missiles. Now here's the portion of the deal that the Republicans are going to go most crazy over. This is the last thing that they were ironing out. So we already knew the framework of the deal, and it was taking a while to really get down the final details and agree on the final part of it. And this was the final part that they were struggling over. The U.S. position originally was just don't, no. You're not going to be allowed to have any weapons at all, and we're going to continue to block that, and that's the end of the conversation. But then Iran said, well, come on, if we're really sitting down and we're negotiating, you guys can't just have everything you want and we get nothing of what we want. I mean, what, you get rid of sanctions to get us back to make our economy what it should be anyway. Gee, thanks. We got to get a little something extra here. We're not asking you to sell us weapons. We're just asking that on the international market, can we buy weapons, you know, in a certain amount of time? Again, it's 5 years for small weapons, 8 years for ballistic missiles. The right's going to say, oh, my God, President Obama arming the Iranians. Told you he was a Manchurian candidate and a Muslim. That's what they're going to say. But what's the reality? And why would the U.S. agree to that? Think about it. Think about it. You have the answer yet? I'll tell you. ISIS. That's why. So Iran, for those of you who don't know, you know, anything about the Middle East or the Sunni-Shia divide, Iran is Shia. ISIS is fundamentalist Sunni. They're Wahhabist or Salafist. The fundamentalist Sunnis want to wipe out the Shias. They hate the Shias so much that they want to wipe out the Shias before they even get to the Americans and all the Westerners. Okay, that's how much they hate them. And Shia militias right now are fighting. So, and what they're doing is they're, you know, scrapping together weapons from different places, and they're not as well armed as they could be. And what they're saying here is, come on, guys, don't be ridiculous. You know that we're your ally in fighting ISIS. You know you want to defeat ISIS. Be reasonable here. We at least give us some kind of weapons or allow us to get some kind of weapons on the international market where we can take care of that. And Kerry and Obama and the international community said that is reasonable. So let's go down that road. So do I like that provision or do I dislike that provision? Not only do I like that provision, I love that provision. I would have given that on day one. It took the Americans forever. It took Kerry forever to finally say, okay, we'll give you in 5 years you can get it. I would have said it day one because I know, apparently, unlike a lot of people in our government, that of course ISIS is a bigger threat than Iran and the Shias. Now, Israel is going to flip a shit over this because, you know, they're enemies with Iran, and Iran has made very hawkish comments against Israel. But Israel has also made very hawkish comments against Iran, and they think it's going to, tip the balance of power in the region. But it's funny how if Israel's mad over this, why are you not also mad about Saudi Arabia being armed to the teeth? I mean, their regime is more fundamentalist, more pro-Shia, more extremist than the Iranian regime, and you're like, you actually partnered with Saudi Arabia to tell America we don't like this Iran deal. So it's not really about, who are the bad guys, who are the good guys, they're repressing their population. It is about geopolitical power and strength, and they don't want Iran to become more Western aligned. So overall, is this a good deal or is it a bad deal? I say for sure it's a good deal. And finally, they say Congress has 60 days to approve or disapprove of the deal. But here's the catch. At the end of the review, lawmakers may pass a resolution of approval, a resolution of disapproval, or do nothing. A vote of disapproval, which would need the support of two-thirds of both the House and the Senate to override a presidential veto, would revoke the president's authority to temporarily waive sanctions implemented by Congress. Obama vowed to veto any legislation that impedes implementation of the nuclear agreement. Congressionally enacted sanctions make up only a portion of the sanctions relief provided to Iran under the agreement. So think about what that means. Now, I also thought, well, Congress may fuck this up. But the reality is, it's going to be hard for them to fuck it up. Why? Because the way the treaty was structured and the way they did the negotiations, it's something that's totally within the power of the president to do without even going through Congress. And what they're saying is certain sanctions put on Iran were put through Congress. Others weren't. So if Congress decides to try to tank this thing, they can only get rid of the sanctions that they put into place in the first place, which is only a small percentage of the sanctions. So again, even if they want to tank the deal, it's going to be hard for them to tank the deal, and it requires two-thirds of both the House and the Senate to get it done. And President Obama's like, I'm going to veto it either way. So you're going to need two-thirds? You're going to be able to get two-thirds? I don't think you're going to be able to get two-thirds. There are going to be some Democrats that, you know, do the wrong thing here, people like Menendez, for example, who's totally anti-Iran and doesn't want peace, and there are some Democrats who will vote with the Republicans, but the reality is you're not going to get two-thirds. So it appears at this point in time that they may have done it, man. They may have did a historic peace deal here, which can change the terrible situation and standoff that's been going on between Iran and the U.S. for a long time now. And remember, one of the most important things to keep bringing up is that even if they violate the deal or we violate the deal or whatever, okay, even if that happens, okay, so we go right back to the sanctions, automatically get slapped back on if something happens. So to be against this deal, it's just there's no argument against this deal. There's no argument. They came to the table. Iran came to the table. They sat down. They negotiated. They conceded, we'll never have a nuclear weapon, and we're fine with that. Just get rid of some of these sanctions. We did our part as well. And now we're at a place where we can actually have a conversation and we can talk. And, you know, we're not on the verge of war like we were under the Bush administration. There's no way you could be against this. Because, again, even if it doesn't work out, and of course it's possible it doesn't work out, well, then the sanctions go right back on, which is what the Republicans want to do anyway, continue to have sanctions, or they might actually want war, which is even more disastrous. But at least for now, that war cry is not as loud as it was before. So today is a great day. This is a great step in the right direction. There's no reason to oppose this, which is why, of course, the Republicans and some Democrats will try to do just that, but it's going to be hard for them to succeed. Okay. Quick break when we come back. Not done on this deal, and I got a whole bunch of other great stuff. Stay right there, guys.
out to his ever mind. Not like you hold me, hold me. Ooh, baby, love never felt so good. Like you hold me, hold me. Through the night, through the thick and thin. Got a lot of things to be talking to you, baby. Every time I love you, in all my life, in all my fears. Tell me, if you really love me, in all my life, in all my fears.
All right, we're back, guys. We got one more on the issue of this Iran peace deal. Let's go to Netanyahu. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in full meltdown mode over the international peace agreement that was just reached with Iran. So he really made some comically desperate missteps over the past week. First, he opened up a Farsi Twitter account, and the whole purpose of that was to explain to the Iranians how evil they are in their own language. Stay classy, big guy. Then he said this: I will refer later to the details of the agreement, but I'll say now, when willing to make an agreement at any cost, this is the result. Okay, well, that's interesting. The way he phrased that, it almost sounds like he doesn't know all the facts yet. He also said, from the initial reports, we can already conclude that this agreement is a historic mistake. So there's only one problem with him saying these things. He said it before the deal was released. Now, you might say, come on, he had access. He had, you know, behind the scenes. He's a head of state. Of course he was able to see a draft of it. Nope. He didn't know the final details of the deal. And he said, oh, I'm against this. When you're willing to make an agreement at any cost, this is the result. What's the result? What are you saying? You don't know the deal, so what are you saying? From initial reports, notice how, initial reports, so you're admitting you don't know. We can already conclude that the agreement was a historic mistake. Dude, enough, enough. You got to calm down, son. I mean, he's a caricature of himself at this point. And then, I even get to my favorite yet. He said, Iran will get a jackpot, a cash bonanza of hundreds of billions of dollars, their own dollars, which will enable it to continue to pursue its aggression and terror in the region and in the world. Iran is going to receive a sure path to nuclear weapons. Netanyahu, the deal says the opposite. See, this is why you should read the deal before you talk. But the reality is he knows that, and he's the war hawk, and he's the one that doesn't want peace. You know, it's like they pretend like they don't want war, but when they're presented with a perfect opportunity to not have war, they're like, fuck that. I don't like that. So then what do you want? What other option is there? Well, I want war. Oh, did I say that out loud? I didn't mean that out loud. I mean, they want war. But they don't want war. They just signed on to this deal and said, part of the deal said, quite literally, we will never try to get a nuclear weapon. Quote, Iran reaffirms that under no circumstances will it ever seek develop, or acquire any nuclear weapons. So they don't want war. They're saying they don't want war, but you're like, oh, they want war. Even though I want war, but I mean they want war. Dude, you're not fucking fooling anybody. And to everybody who might say, well, I don't believe Iran. Okay, you don't have to believe them. The deal is based on verification. It's not based on just you trust them. This is why the IAEA exists. This is why the UN exists. They go in and they verify this shit. But again, Netanyahu still says no because it doesn't matter what the terms of the deal are. He doesn't want a deal. It's that simple. Now, another really surprising aspect of this is that Netanyahu's opponents are shocked and disappointed that Netanyahu control Obama. So Yitzhak, I'm definitely pronouncing that wrong, Herzog, of the allegedly less hawkish than Likud Zionist Union, another party in Israel, political party, said, quote, we have a long list of complaints about Netanyahu, but this is without question his worst failure. Because of the way he ran this over the last year, the door of the White House was closed to him. Half of Congress doesn't speak to him. Also, Yair Lapid, another key member of the opposition, said, quote, urged Netanyahu to resign on Monday for failing to convince the U.S. to follow Israel's demands. You want to talk about a prima donna? Dude, we give you billions of dollars a year, Israel. You don't give it to us. What kind of a fucking relationship is this? We give them billions of dollars a year. We pay for Iron Dome. We say we got your back no matter what the fuck happens. We're on your side 100% of the Middle East. And what happens? When we try to make peace in a deal with a different country, they're like, I want the prime minister to resign because he couldn't control the head of the United States of America. He couldn't control the president. Well, why should any leader of any country ever be able to control the head of our country? Aren't we a sovereign fucking country? Why the fuck would any prime minister, any leader anywhere be able to say, I can't believe you weren't able to control the president of the U.S.? What kind of bullshit is this? That's not the way, look, when I read this, it struck me, oh, no. U.S. has to reestablish with Israel exactly what the fuck is going on in our relationship here. We're not your bitch, okay? We're not a satellite state for you. We are our own state, and again, if anything, maybe you should listen to us because we give you billions of dollars a year. We pay for your defense. We pay for Iron Dome, and you're going to slap us in the face when we're trying to make peace in the region? No, fuck that. But you guys already know, I've said it time and time again, even in regards to the Palestinian situation. You got to force Israel, you know, to do the right thing. You got to say we're going to cut the funding, we're going to lift the veto with the UN, we're going to side with the Palestinian state, and we're going to support the BDS movement unless you sit down and do a deal immediately. So it's about time we finally said enough with Likud and with Netanyahu and with the right wing in Israel, because they're just getting us into more and more trouble, just like our own right wing, man. Our own right wing marches towards war, does all the rhetoric of war, pushes for war, and the entire time they do it, they point their finger at the other countries and say, why do you want war? But I just told you, Iran doesn't want war. They signed the peace deal. They signed the peace deal. You, Netanyahu, you Republicans in America, are trying to block the peace deal. Remind me again who the bad guys are? It appears pretty clear. Okay. Next. Time for a Fox News fight. That's always interesting. Eric Bolling and Geraldo Rivera went at it on the Fox News show The Five on the issue of immigration. Let's watch.
You know what? Kind of laugh it off, make fun of his hair, maybe, because, you know, eventually you want to still play golf at his course, right? But Trump is not, he's not going to win the nomination, but is tapped into the red-blooded American bloodstream right now, the people that are sick of watching a skinny community organizer go out there and run this country into the ground, and they want to see a more muscular approach.
You refer to your president as a skinny community organizer?
I do.
Disrespectful.
I don't think so. I think you said a lot worse about Republicans.
Trump, who is my friend, is going to learn that immigration is like a cheap drug. You get a big bang, a real quick high, and a very long hang.
Well, it's not a quick high when people are being murdered in San Francisco.
Well,
and it's not a quick high when people are escaping prisons in Mexico and selling heroin and cocaine
to
our children.
Misery of that family.
It's not exploiting it.
It is exactly
you're
how
exploiting it by downplaying
nothing
it.
Nothing to do with immigration.
How does it not?
But
it's a sanctuary policy.
You've been doing this on the air. You're equating Trump's comments with all immigrants. What he had said was, and we've talked about this quite a bit, is Trump's comments specifically pointed at illegals.
I'm talking about the reaction to Trump, and you tell me that it's not an immigration response.
I think, and Jesse's right, I think that it is tapping into the
it is
the
exploiting,
red
it is exploiting and sensationalizing
from a guy who exploits and sensationalizes everything.
Are you
really
talking to me?
Yes.
You're lucky that you're my friend. I'd knock you out right now.
Well,
that's absolute BS.
We can take this up later. How
right.
has,
that
it,
is absolute
how,
bogus.
How you say
okay.
that Trump is
you're
exploiting.
Talking I exploit and sensationalize. What do? Where do you get your stuff from?
I'm
right wing.
You're saying that Donald
is giving
Trump
you
is
your
right.
friend.
Okay,
a woman's
room?
Death.
Get out.
It's her death.
All right.
You're downplaying it.
We're going to have a commercial coming up.
Oh, that was adorable. Geraldo gets angry like a guy in, like, the 1920s. He almost said, good googly moogly. I can't believe you did that. You saw when he threw the sheet of paper? Like, that was, I'm angry. Goodness gracious, Eric. How dare you? Angry paper. And he, like, starts moving his head and his hair's bouncing and shit. I wonder if he has a hairpiece. Probably not. His hairpiece would have, like, fallen off if he had one during that exchange. What's the reality? It's Fox News. The entire fucking network is based on exploiting tragedies. For fuck's sake, Eric Bolling is going to accuse other people of exploiting tragedies. What does Fox News do? What do you do anytime any Muslim does any kind of criminal act or terror attack? All you want to do on your show, it was Bob Beckel who said, you know, we shouldn't allow any Muslim immigrants into the country. We should kick them out of the schools. And you sat there nodding along in agreement. You didn't say that. Oh, you're exploiting a tragedy. Why would you exploit the tragedy? You're going to blame all Muslims, quite literally, because you're saying don't let them in the schools anymore. Don't allow any more Muslim immigrants here to go to the schools. So you're going to use this to say all Muslims are guilty. And to try to change policy to affect all Muslims. Wouldn't that you be exploiting a tragedy? And, I mean, another good example. There was a Fox News segment where there was a guy who abused food stamps. I'm not even sure this shit was real, man, because the guy was like a surfer dude. It looked like he was wearing a long surfer wig. He spoke like a surfer dude, bro. He would talk like that. He was just such like a caricature. He was a stereotype of like the lazy Californian or whatever. And he was abusing food stamps. He was open about it. He's like, yeah, I use it, and I don't plan on ever getting a job, like, toodler. And Fox News used that to try to say, oh, the fucking food stamp program! Cut it for everybody. Again, we went over the numbers. Literally only 1% fraud, waste, and abuse rate, according to the USDA in the food stamp program. And they're using that segment. Oh, politicize it! Blame everybody who's on food stamps. So, yes, of course, Fox News, that's what they do. That's what you guys do. Who's politicizing this tragedy of a woman being murdered? Is it Geraldo Rivera who says, look, this is a horrible thing, but don't blame all immigrants? Or is it Fox News, the other hosts, Eric Bolling and Jesse Waters, who are trying to use this to say, oh, kick out the illegals. You ought to do that. Well, you're obviously politicizing it. What are you talking about? And the funniest thing was his distinction when Eric Bolling tried to clarify what Trump was saying, as if, by the way, it's like, you know, you don't get it. Trump was being reasonable. Yeah, he was, I'm sure. He's like, Trump didn't say all immigrants are rapists. Trump just said illegals. 11 million undocumented immigrants in America, as he would call them, illegals. 11 million are rapists? No, but see, Eric, that's just the thing. No matter how you slice it or dice it, no matter how much you bend over backwards to try to be kind in your interpretation to Donald Trump, it is still factually incorrect. And therein lies the problem with you, therein lies the problem with your show, therein lies the problem with your network. You have this facade of, we're keeping it real and we're telling the truth to the American people. But the reality is virtually everything you say is just simply inaccurate and untrue. Okay. Let's go to Scott Walker. I got another Scott Walker story. Aren't you lucky? So Scott Walker officially announced his presidential campaign. We've known for a while now that he was going to run, but he just held off in order to avoid campaign finance laws. This is something that virtually all the Republicans are doing. But the letter that he sent to his supporters when he did officially announce is basically like a parody. It's like a caricature of a modern-day Republican. So he talks about how he's against gay marriage and he's against abortion and I'm the son of a Baptist preacher and I'm super religious. But here's the best part. And to be clear about this, the best part is the very beginning of the letter. Listen to what he says. My relationship with God drives every major decision in my life. Each day I pray and then take time to read the Bible and from a devotional named Jesus Calling. Let me just pause here real fast. Every major decision in your life, you talk to your imaginary friend. Okay, you're eliminated. You're already out of the running. I need a rational, logical human being in office. Whether conservative or liberal, irrelevant. Just overall, the most important thing is you got to be somewhat rational. You got to be logical. You got to care about this world. He says, no, every major decision, I talk to my imaginary friend. Okay, well, then you need psychiatric drugs. What do you want me to tell you? Then he says, each day I pray and take time to read from the Bible and a devotional named Jesus Calling. Pray, read from the Bible, and Jesus Calling. How much? That's like an hour and a half a day, son. That's what you're devoting to religion? Again, eliminated. I can't have you doing that when Vladimir Putin is crusading and taking parts of Ukraine on a Wednesday before brunch. Okay, I need you to focus, son. I don't know. Pakistan and India got a little thing going on. Pakistan has nuclear weapons. You're going to be sitting there on the verge of speaking in tongues. I can't have you do it. It doesn't make any sense. So already fucking crazy. This is the very beginning of the letter that he's announcing he's running for president. He says, as you can imagine, the months leading up to my announcement that I would run for president of the United States were filled with lots of prayers and soul searching. More fucking prayers. How many hours a day are you going to pray? Are you going to pray like 12 hours a day? Is that what you're going to do? You're going to make the White House a Christian madrasa? Is that what you want to do? He says, here's why. I need to be certain that running God's calling, not just man's calling, I am certain this is God's plan for me, and I am humbled to be a candidate for president of the United States of America. God, I hate that. I hate that. Bill Maher nailed it when he said that religion is arrogance parading or masquerading as humility. So the idea is, I ask God. I'm so humble that I ask God whether or not I should run for president. And God said, oh, yes, Scott Walker, the world needs you. You're so special. You're the chosen one. You should run for president. But he's making the most arrogant claim ever. God wants me. He's making that claim with this mask of, I'm so humble, I didn't even choose to run myself. I had to ask for permission from the Almighty. Oh, my God, you're so fucking insufferable. And here's the thing about this story. Dude, other Republican candidates have said that God told them to run. Rick Perry did it. Michelle Bachmann did it. Others have done it. But when they said it, it was a gaffe. It was like in the middle of an interview or something like that. It would slip out. Yeah, I prayed on it and God said blah, 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 blah. And everybody's like, ah, ha, ha, fucking idiot, I can't believe you said that. Dude, Scott Walker wrote it out in his letter to his activists when he told them he's running. He wrote it out and laid it out in fine detail, and it was approved by his fucking staff. Like, yeah, go with that. God wants you. You're the chosen one. Imagine for a second it was a Muslim. Imagine it was Keith Ellison, who's a Muslim. He runs for president. He writes, Allah has told me that I should run America. What would the response be in the United States of America? Any other religion? People would be like, the fuck? What if a Mormon did that? What if a Scientologist did that? We look at him like, are you a crazy person? Are you stupid? Why would you say that? That's ridiculous. But when it's the variety of crazy that is most prevalent in America, people look at it like there's the news outlets aren't even talking about this today. The mainstream media outlets, nobody's like, this is fucking weird and really like theocracy-like. Nobody spoke about it. I said it before, I'll say it again. At the very beginning, I thought Scott Walker was going to be, you know, a contender. That he might be hard to beat because he's so vanilla. He might get the, you know, the nomination of the party because he's so, he just fits into the background. But the reality is, I was wrong in my initial estimation. He's way too stupid. He's just way too stupid where even the right-wing base, something's off there. Okay. Speaking of too stupid, Rick Santorum, here we go. So Rick Santorum was interviewed by the conservative outlet, The Daily Caller, on the same day that Scott Walker announced his candidacy. And he was asked a question about Scott Walker and his wife, because his wife came out as torn on the issue of gay marriage. Now, typically, whenever a candidate is asked about the family of another candidate, whether it's the kids or the wife or whatever, their response is something along the lines of, come on, family is off limits, and the race is about us and America and the policy direction we should go in, and it's about President Obama and how much he failed and, you know, yada, yada, yada. So you dodge the question, but you say, come on, that's not relevant to what's happening here. Not Rick Santorum. See, Rick Santorum is not savvy enough to know to do that. So here's what he said when he was asked about Scott Walker's wife. Quote, spouses matter. I saw that repeatedly with Republican presidents. When your spouse is not in sync with you, particularly on cultural issues, moral issues, what I've seen over time is that presidents as well as members of Congress tend not to be as active on those issues. Not to say they're going to change their positions. They rarely, to my knowledge, change their positions. They tend not to do things that put them out there, fighting this fight when they know they're going to have some disharmony at home. You know what my takeaway from this story is? The GOP is going to self-destruct again, just like it did in 2008 and like it did in 2012. Because they're just simply too out of touch with the rest of America to win the presidency right now. Look at Rick Santorum. He's asked about the wife of another candidate. And he's like, I don't like her and what she stands for. And it's going to affect policy. And it's going to, you know, spouses matter. She's going to say things in his ear that are more open-minded. And we can't have that. We got to be bigots. That's how we roll. You know what else this tells me? Like, Rick Santorum is not just using this Christian Taliban bullshit to exploit to get votes. He really fucking believes it. So you can look at a guy like George Bush, for example, and he, you know, would speak about abortion, and he'd speak about social issues when he was running, and it was more of an act to try to do people over to get votes. In fact, Cheney said it at one point. Now, it's like he did nothing on the issue with stem cell research. He kind of froze it, and I guess you could say he did 5% of what he promised to that base. But Cheney admitted, look, afterwards, he's like, we just use these dumb fucks, these religious assholes, to get into power. With Santorum, he really fucking believes it. He's like, no, I'm not fucking around here, man. I'm so insane and right-wing and moralistic on social issues that I'm even going to attack the wives of other candidates because they're not bigoted and crazy enough. And when he's saying, look, other, you know, people, their wives have influenced them. I don't know who he's referring to there, but maybe it is Bush. Maybe it is some other Republicans who he thought, ah, you're not crazy enough, son. You're not restrictive enough. You're not authoritarian enough. My only response to this is, go ahead, Rick. Go further down that path. All the Republicans, keep attacking each other, man. This is why the Republican donors came out recently and said, stop, you fucking crazy people. You're going to ruin it. You're going to ruin it again. No, my response is, don't listen to those guys. Go ahead. Keep going down this path, and then watch how you get destroyed in a general election. Because here's what's for sure. If you keep talking like this, you're going to get destroyed. All right, next, Bill Cosby. So the news broke last week that Bill Cosby actually admitted to drugging women because he wanted to have sex with them. He admitted it in a 2005 court case, and the records were just revealed. So naturally, since there are about 40 accusers saying he raped them, and he even admitted to the wrongdoing, who's going to come to his defense? Black conservatives. There's a black conservative group named Project 21, and they said the following, or I should say Mediaite reports, quote, Project 21 is defending Bill Cosby. At issue was how Judge Eduardo Robreno decided to release the documents due to Cosby's role as a public moralist, specifically with his pound cake speech talking about crime and the responsibility of black families. In the Project 21 press release, co-chair Horace Cooper says, "This ruling is appalling. A decision to unseal documents is a weighty one and should only occur under exceptional circumstances." Member DeRoy Murdoch also said that Americans should be free to express themselves without fearing that their views will be used later to justify breaching confidential documents in what resembles political score settling by federal judges. Okay. This may be the most ridiculous group in America. The guy said, not the fact that Cosby raped 40 women is appalling. Not the fact that he admitted to it. Like, oh, yeah, I partook in this. That's not appalling. He's not appalled by the crimes. He's appalled by the fact that the judge released the records. And he said it, quote, should only occur, releasing the documents, under exceptional circumstances. 40 people saying I was raped. That's not exceptional? When does it become exceptional? 46 people? 102 people? The population of the state of Botswana? What the fuck is wrong with you? What is wrong with you? You know what this reminds me of? Hurricane Katrina. In Hurricane Katrina, conservatives were mad at the people who were looting, mostly just to get food and things to survive because their fucking houses were underwater. They had nowhere to go. Conservatives were mad at that instead of being mad at the fact that the federal government and the state government and the local government had a piss-poor response to the hurricane and it flooded everything and they didn't evacuate everybody on time. In the midst of devastation and people dying and living in a horrible situation with, you know, the situation still unfolding, instead of being mad and feeling sympathy for these people, they were mad at the looting. Same thing here. The guy said, I had to release the documents. He's such a fucking hypocrite, lecturing everybody about morality, and he's raping people. I had to release the documents. They're not mad at Bill Cosby for the rapes and admitting that he drugged women. They're mad at the judge. Oh, God, how dare you release that, man? You should only release that under exceptional circumstances. Everybody knows 40 rape accusers. That's not exceptional at all. Dude, very simply, let's just put it out there as clear as possible. Your moral compass is broken if you look at that situation and you're more mad at the judge. By the way, the judge, in my opinion, yeah, he shouldn't have released it if he's not supposed to release it if Cosby was not a hypocrite. But when you're that big of a hypocrite and you're lecturing everybody about morality, oh, you son of a bitch, I'm going to release those documents, I'm going to release it with a smile on my face, and you should be put in jail. Okay, I'm out of time, guys. I love you. I'll see you tomorrow. Peace.